in this life, we get up each day, hopefully in a healthy state. We spend most of it putting our trust and faith in so many others to care for us. We wonder our banker, our stockbroker, our insurance agent, expect them to take good care of our money. Don't lose it. Make us a lot of money. Make our money grow. We go to our church, our synagogue, our temples, once, twice a week. Get down on our knees, pray, ask for help, guidance, forgiveness, and in effect expect our priest or our rabbi or our shaman to get us through the pearly gates. And then, of course, we go to our physicians, our various medical specialists, our dentists, our chiropractors, and hand them an insurance card or hand them a check and expect them to make us well. The common denominator in all of these scenarios is that we are expecting someone else to do the job that we are responsible for. We've become too lazy to care for our own money, to do our own studies, to do our own homework, to take care of that which will be needed to get us through our older years or to leave a sizable estate of any type to our heirs, our children, our grandchildren, etc. We expect our spiritual guidance counselors to hand us the keys to the gates of heaven or whatever, when ultimately it is our responsibility as to where we spend eternity, if there is such a place. And finally, we expect our doctor to give us a shot and give us a magic pill and make us well and cure us of all of our ailments. And yet, it is we who are ultimately responsible for our own well-being, our own health. And so once again, we forget about this terminology of self-responsibility. We are spoiled children in this country. We have been weaned from the womb to expect government to be the be-all, do-all, cure-all entity, which it seems to want to be. I, for one, will take responsibility for my own future, financially, spiritually, health, and otherwise. And so we welcome you once again to another installment of Perspectives on America. I am your host and commentator, Jeffrey Bennett, and you are listening to us this day on themicroeffect.com. We welcome you to our ongoing series discussing health, wellness. Over the past few weeks, we have concentrated predominantly on the issue of cancer. There is a cancer in this nation, politically, spiritually, physically, and pretty much every other possible way. Tonight, we're going back and revisit an old series that I actually recorded many years ago, dealing with X-rays. And we're going to attempt to answer the question, are they a major cause of cancer and heart disease? Because the evidence appears to show that to be true. And yet we'll go to the dentist once, twice a year. He's going to want to X-ray us. I happen to have a thyroid condition, which I take a daily pill for. And I am working diligently to get off of that daily pill, but I need to work with my teeth first. Because I believe that once I cure my periodontal problems from too many years of smoking, that I'll be able to wean myself off of this drug. And so we begin. The question once again, are X-rays a major cause of cancer and heart disease? We are going to talk tonight as part of our ongoing continuing education about cancer. We're going to talk about X-rays, a major cause of cancer and heart disease. Now, my friends, yesterday morning I awoke quite early. Actually, I didn't. I woke up very late yesterday. I'd been up quite late the night before, and I've been making a habit of this again, but I'm not properly supplementing myself, nutritionally speaking. And the big health news that was on the major news networks yesterday had to do with the fact that CT scans, or CAT scans as they're commonly known, there has been a study made that CAT scans are actually more dangerous. They are putting more radiation into our bodies than if we had been standing downwind of the tragic incident at Three Mile Island so many years ago. That's right. The discussions now are that the amount of radiation that CAT scans are putting into our bodies years later is bringing about cancer going through all three of the major local networks here in my community in Phoenix, Arizona, ABC, CBS, and NBC. All three of these networks on a local basis. We're talking about this CAT scan business. And I'm sure this was happening all over the nation. The local stations would go out and bring in their own so-called medical experts, all of whom are now in support of this recent study. Aren't these the same medical experts that have been prescribing CAT scans and x-rays to us all these years? My friends, medical x-rays may in fact be responsible for a large portion of cancer and coronary heart disease cases. When Wilhelm Roentgen discovered x-rays in 1895, doctors and physicians saw the practical potential of x-rays at once and rushed to experiment with them. Many physicians built their own x-ray equipment with mixed results, of course. Some homebrew x-ray machines produced no radiation whatsoever. Others produced enough to irradiate everyone in the next room. The ability to see inside the human body for the first time was a marvelous, mysterious, and deeply provocative discovery. Roentgen trained x-rays on his wife's hand for 15 minutes, producing a macabre image of the bones of her hand adorned by her wedding ring. Now, Roentgen's biographer, Otto Glasser, says that Mrs. Roentgen could hardly believe that this bony hand was her own and shuddered at the thought that she was seeing her own skeleton. To Mrs. Roentgen, as to many others later, this experience gave a vague premonition of death. Within the year, physicians were using x-rays for diagnosis and as a new way of gathering evidence to protect themselves against malpractice suits. Almost immediately during 1895 and 96, it also became clear that x-rays could cause serious medical problems. Some physicians received burns that would not heal, requiring amputation of their fingers. Others developed fatal cancers. At that time, antibiotics had not yet been discovered, so physicians had only a small number of treatments they could offer their patients. X-rays gave them a range of new procedures that were very high-tech, bordering on the miraculous, and which seemed to hold out promise to the sick. And thus the medical world embraced these mysterious, invisible rays with great enthusiasm. Now, understandably, physicians at the time often thought they observed therapeutic benefits, where controlled experiments today find none. Just prior to 1920, the editor of American X-ray Journal said, quote, "There are about 100 named diseases that yield favorably to X-ray treatment," end quote. Now, in her informative history of the technology, entitled Multiple Exposures, Chronicles of the Radiation Age, Catherine Caulfield comments on this period, where she stated, "Radiation treatment for benign non-cancer diseases became a medical craze that lasted for 40 or more years. Large groups of people were needlessly irradiated for such minor problems as ringworm and acne. Most women had their ovaries irradiated as treatment for depression." Such uses of x-rays would today be viewed as quackery, but many of them were accepted medical practice well into the 1950s. Physicians weren't the only ones enthusiastic about x-ray therapies, by the way. If you get a large enough dose of x-rays, your hair falls out. And so, Caulfield reports, quote, "Beauty shops installed x-ray equipment to remove their customers' unwanted facial and body hair." Roentgen's discovery of x-rays in 1895 led directly to Henri Becquerel's discovery of the radioactivity of uranium in 1896, and then to the discovery of radium by Marie Curie and her husband Pierre in 1898, for which Basquiat and the Curies were jointly awarded the Nobel Prize in 1903. 20 years later, by the way, Madame Curie would die of acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Soon, alongside X-rays, radioactive radium was being prescribed by physicians. Radium treatments were prescribed for heart trouble, impotence, ulcers, depression, arthritis, cancer, high blood pressure, blindness, and TB, tuberculosis, among other ailments, of course. But soon, radioactive toothpaste was being marketed, and then radioactive skin cream. In Germany, chocolate bars containing radium were sold as a rejuvenator. In the United States, hundreds of thousands of people began drinking bottled water laced with radium as a general elixir known popularly as liquid sunshine. Now, as recently as 1952, Life magazine wrote about the beneficial effects of inhaling radioactive radon gas in deep mines. The beneficial effects. Even today, the Merry Widow Health Mine near Butte, Montana, and the nearby Sunshine Radon Health Mine advertise that visitors to the mines report multiple benefits from inhaling radioactive radon, even though numerous studies now indicate that the only demonstrable health effect of radon gas is lung cancer. Thus, the medical world and popular culture together embraced X-rays and other radioactive emanations. And they embrace them as miraculous remedies, gifts to humanity from the foremost geniuses of an inventive age. Why do we take the time to give you this boring history? And to many of you, it is boring, I'm sure, because we're no longer used to sitting down being taught things of importance. And my friends, I believe that what we are sharing with you tonight is of tremendous importance, because one must understand the basis of X-ray technology and how it has affected us. Remember, in Dr. Kelly's book, he talked about at the turn of the century. Now, stop and think about this. The X-ray machine, or X-rays, were discovered in 1895. So, but 5 years later, we face the turn of the century, the year 1900, or 1901, if you wish to get technically correct. Cancer, at that time, 1 in 8,000 people was diagnosed in their lifetime to be cancerous at over 100 years ago. And today, it averages 1.5 out of every 3 people. I'm not even sure those numbers are correct. What is it? It's 1 out of every 2 men and 2 out of every 3 women, something of that nature. But the fact remains that we are 100 years later. Antibiotics have grown. X-ray technology has advanced. But has it truly improved, or are these things causing us more health-related problems down the road? And now with these new reports coming out about the dangers that CAT scan machines can be giving us and the problems they can be causing us, I think that this little lesson in history becomes well worth spending the time on. In the popular imagination, these technologies we've discussed suffered a serious setback when atomic and hydrogen bombs were detonated over Japan in 1945. Now, even though the bombs arguably shortened World War II and saved American lives, John Hershey's description of the human devastation in Hiroshima forever imprinted the ruin, imprinted the mushroom cloud in the popular mind as an omen of unutterable ruin. Despite substantial efforts to cast the bomb in a positive light, radiation technology would never recover the luster it had gained prior to World War II. And don't forget, one of the key elements in the manufacture of that bomb, my friends, was fluoride. 7 years after the nuclear bombs were used in war, Dwight Eisenhower set the U.S. government on a new course, intending to show the world that nuclear weapons, radioactivity, and radiation were not harbingers of death, but were in fact powerful, benign servants offering almost limitless benefits to humankind. these Atoms for Peace, as they were known. This was a program that was born explicitly aimed at convincing Americans and the world that these new technologies were full of hope, and that nuclear power reactors should be developed with tax dollars to generate electricity. The promise of this newest technical advance seemed too good to be true. Electricity? Too cheap to meter? It sounds too good to be true. It's turned out that it really was. The Atomic Energy Act of 1946 created the Civilian Atomic Energy Commission. But as a practical matter, the nation's top military commanders maintained close control over the development of all nuclear technologies. And thus, by a series of historical accidents, all the major sources of ionizing radiation fell under the purview of people and institutions who had no reason to want to explore the early knowledge that radiation, in fact, was harmful. 1927, Hermann J. Müller had demonstrated that X-rays caused inheritable genetic damage, and he received a Nobel Prize for his efforts. 1927! However, he had performed his experiments on fruit flies, and it was easy, or at least convenient, to dismiss his findings as irrelevant to humans. Now, to physicians, radiation seemed a promising new therapy for treating nearly every ailment under the sun. For the military and the Joint Commission on Atomic Energy in Congress, it unleashed hundreds of billions of dollars, a veritable flood of taxpayer funds, most of which came with almost no oversight because of official secrecy surrounding weapons development. For private sector government contractors like Union Carbide, Monsanto Chemical Company, General Electric, Bechtel Corp., DuPont, Martin Marietta, and others, it meant an opportunity to join the elite military-industrial complex, whose growing political power President Eisenhower warned against in his final address to Congress in 1959. Now, throughout the 1950s, the military detonated A-bombs above ground at the Nevada test site, showering downward civilian populations with radioactivity. At the Hanford Reservation in Washington State, technicians intentionally released huge clouds of radioactivity to see what would happen to the human populations thus exposed. In one Hanford experiment, 500,000 curies of radioactive iodine were released. Iodine collects, by the way, in the human thyroid gland. The victims of this experiment, mostly Native Americans, were not told for about 45 years, nearly a half century. American sailors on ships, soldiers on the ground, were exposed to large doses of radioactivity just to see what would happen to them. The military brass insisted that being showered with radiation was harmless. In his autobiography, Carl Z. Morgan, who served as radiation safety director at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Clinton, Tennessee, he served in that position from 1944 to 1971, recalled, quote, "The Veterans Administration seems always on the defensive to make sure the victims are not compensated," end of quote. Morgan recounted the story of John D. Smitherman, a U.S. Navy man who received large doses of radiation during A-bomb experiments on Bikini Atoll in 1946. His words are as follows. "The Veterans Administration denied any connection to radiation exposure until 1988, when it had awarded his widow benefits. By the time of his death, Smitherman's body was almost consumed by cancers of the lung, bronchial lymph nodes, diaphragm, spleen, pancreas, intestines, stomach, liver, and adrenal glands." In 1989, a year after it had awarded the benefits, the VA revoked them from Smitherman's widow. This is how we treat our veterans in this country. Starting in the 1940s and continuing into the 1960s, thousands of uranium miners were told that breathing radon gas in the uranium mines of New Mexico was perfectly safe. Only now are the radon-caused lung cancers being tallied up as the truth leaks out 50 years too late. In retrospect, a kind of nuclear mania swept the industrial world. What biotechnology and high-tech computers are today, atomic energy was in the 1950s and early 60s. Government contractors spent billions to develop a nuclear-powered airplane, even though simple engineering calculations told them early in the project that such a plane would be too heavy to carry a useful cargo. Monsanto Research Corporation proposed a plutonium-powered coffee pot that would boil water for 100 years without refueling. A Boston company proposed cufflinks made of radioactive uranium for the simple reason that uranium is heavier than lead and the unusual weight prevents cuffs from riding up. In 1957, the Atomic Energy Commission established its plowshare division, named, of course, for the biblical, quote, swords into plowshares, end quote, phrasing in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4. Our government and its industrial partners were determined to show the world that this technology was benign, no matter what the facts might be. No different than our ongoing, continuing pieces on fluoridation. July 14, 1958, Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, arrived in Alaska to announce Project Chariot, a plan to carve a new harbor out of the Alaska coast by detonating up to 6 H-bombs. Well, you can well imagine there was a tremendous political fight documented in Dan O'Neill's book, The Firecracker Boys. The plan was shelved. Another plan was developed to blast a new canal across Central America with atomic bombs, simply to give the U.S. some leverage in negotiating with Panama over control of the canal. That plan, too, thank God, was scrapped. 1967. An A-bomb was detonated underground in New Mexico to release natural gas trapped in shale rock formations. Trapped gas was in fact released, but as the project's engineers should have been able to predict, the gas turned out to be radioactive. So the hole in the ground was plugged, and a bronze plaque in the desert is all that remains visible of Project Gas Buggy. In sum, according to New York Times columnist H. Peter Metzger, the Atomic Energy Commission wasted billions of dollars on crackpot schemes, all for the purpose of proving that nuclear technology was beneficial and not in any way harmful. The plowshare division may have been a complete failure, but one lasting result emerged from all these efforts. A powerful culture of denial sank deep roots into the heart of scientific and industrial America, and the average American has fallen sucker to this denial. They are in complete and total denial. The government wouldn't do that to us now, would they? Fluoride must be good. The government would never, never recommend that we fluoridate our water if it was going to be harmful to our health. And certainly the government never would have done things intentionally with them radioactive bombs that were going to hurt people. I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect of the population in Nevada must have amongst the highest rates of cancer of any state in these United States of America. I received a phone call recently from a woman. She lives in northern Arizona, just miles from the Utah-Arizona border. She has a young granddaughter, age of 4, who has a brain tumor, cancer, at the age of 4. And according to the way I understand the story, there has been a somewhat recent rash of cancers going on in that region of the Arizona-Utah border. I begin to look back in the 1950s as all this testing was being done. We talked earlier tonight about the testing that was being done in Nevada. They don't discuss the testing that took place in Utah. I mean, after all, it was a lowly populated state and no big deal. Probably not going to hurt anybody. Besides, we just want to see what it's going to do and how the people are going to react. Yeah, they want to see how far they can push the button. And if the public doesn't raise any questions or concerns or outcry, then they'll raise the bar a little higher. I've never made any bones about it. One of my favorite actors was John Wayne. In 1956, I believe, there was a film released starring John Wayne, Susan Hayward, Agnes Moorehead, who you'll probably remember as the mother on the old Bewitched television program. Dick Powell was the director of the film. Pedro Armendariz was one of the supporting folks in the film. Now, these are all names that are fairly well known, specifically to people like Bob and Joyce sitting out there in the Carolinas. They're of an age. There probably isn't a name that I mentioned that they don't recognize. They made a film back in 1955 or so. It was released in 56. It was called The Conqueror, and it was a loose biography of Genghis Khan. Of course, in the film, he was called something else, Temujin. And this was all filmed out in the deserts of Utah. Some 8 years later, John Wayne had a lung removed. Cancer. By the time John Wayne had his lung removed from cancer, Dick Powell had already died of cancer. Pedro Armendariz's last movie was made in 1963 or 4, From Russia with Love. Shortly thereafter, he died of cancer. Agnes Moorehead eventually succumbed to cancer, as did Susan Hayward, and untold numbers of technicians, cameramen, script people, artists, makeup people, lighting and electrical managers. Tremendously high cancer, but radioactivity is going to cause no problem. We just do these things to see what its effect on the people is going to be.
Let's hold these thoughts for just a short while as we break for commercial moments, messages from the network. You're listening to Perspectives on America. I'm Jeff Bennett. Our subject today is X-rays. Is it a cause of heart disease and cancer? We'll return to this issue in just a few moments. We'll be right back. Welcome back, my friends. Interestingly enough, this series, as I mentioned, was recorded some years ago, and yet all the information in it remains quite timeless. The dangers are still there. Have improvements been made to X-ray technology? I suppose to some degree. One of the things that I recall listening to while editing and preparing this program for this broadcast, and I don't recall the percentages, but those who are referred to as X-ray technologists, as it were, have a far greater chance of acquiring leukemia than almost anyone else in the medical profession. We spend a fair amount of time discussing the historical aspects of X-rays because one, as with everything else we do in this life, needs to understand where it all comes from before we can understand what we're facing each time that we face the dreaded X-ray machine, you know, with the technician that runs behind the wall so quickly. So let us return now to X-rays, a major cause of heart disease and cancer. Let's go back to 1910. In addition to X-rays, the medical community was using, at that time, radioactive radium extensively for therapy. Radium was also used industrially to make glow-in-the-dark watch dials, doll's eyes, fish bait, gun sights, and other items. However, by the mid-1920s, it became clear that many young women painting radium onto watch dials were dying. In one case, the employer, U.S. Radium, in West Orange, New Jersey, insisted the women were dying because of poor personal hygiene. But studies of the workplace concluded in 1924 and 1925 that all workers were being exposed to excessive radiation. And thus humans learn by trial and error that alpha and gamma radiation from radium can be extremely dangerous, even in small quantities. December 2, 1942. The first human-created nuclear reactor began operating in a secret lab beneath the bleachers at Stagg Field, University of Chicago. The purpose of the reactor was first to demonstrate that nuclear fission could be achieved and controlled, and secondly, to manufacture plutonium for a bomb. Dr. Arthur Compton headed this Manhattan Project, the code name for the U.S. effort to make the A-bomb. At that time, the world inventory of radium totaled about 2 pounds. The nuclear reactors built in Chicago and then in Tennessee and Hanford, Washington, would hold inventories with the radioactive equivalent of thousands of tons of radium. Many of the radioactive elements in these nuclear reactors were new. Unknown characteristics, unknown side effects, and end results. Compton and his colleagues insisted that safety standards had to be developed to protect workers from the harms of radiation. Early in 1943, Compton hired a radiologist, a chemist, and 3 physicists to set radiation safety standards and to develop measuring equipment to assure that the standards were met. These 5 scientists were called health physicists. Physicists concerned about health. To this day, scientists studying the health effects of radiation call themselves health physicists. X-ray specialists are called radiologists. Now, by September 1943, the initial group of health physicists moved to Clinton, Tennessee, where an enormous industrial facility was being built to process uranium. This became known as the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. In 1944, one of the original 5 health physicists, Carl Z. Morgan, was named director of the Health Physics Division at Oak Ridge, a position he held for 29 years until 1972 when he reached retirement age. How he avoided getting cancer and kicking the bucket, I do not know. Morgan played a central role in the development of the health physics profession and in setting radiation standards worldwide. The Health Physics Society was organized in 1955 with Morgan as its president pro tem. He then served as the society's first elected president in 1956 and 7. From 55 to 77, Morgan served as editor-in-chief of the society's professional journal, Health Physics. In 66, an International Radiation Protection Association was established, representing professionals in 30 countries. And guess who was elected its first president? That's right, Carl Morgan.
Now, most radiation standards are set by International Commission on Radiological Protection, the ICRP, which in 1950 grew out of an earlier standard-setting group, the International X-ray and Radium Protection Committee. Morgan served as one of the ICRP's 13 members from 1950 to 71, and during that time, he chaired the ICRP's Committee on Internal Doses, setting radiation standards, which were then adopted worldwide. It seems clear why Morgan is often described as the father of health physics. But in recent years, Morgan had described and criticized the work of the ICRP. Morgan says the ICRP has suffered from two major blind spots. First, the committee has never focused on harm to the public from excessive exposure to medical X-rays. And then by the mid-60s, the ICRP began setting standards for radioactivity that protected the nuclear industry rather than the public. According to Morgan, who is still an emeritus member of the ICRPs, the ICRP began ignoring serious radiation hazards in the early 60s. Morgan writes thusly, "The period of atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons by the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and the USSR is a sad page in the history of civilized man. Without question, it was the cause of hundreds of thousands of cancer deaths, and yet there was complete silence on the part of the ICRP. During the years of 1960 to 65, Morgan continues, most members of the ICRP either worked directly with the nuclear weapons industry or indirectly received most of their funding for their research from this industry. Perhaps they were reluctant to bite the hand that feeds them." End of Morgan's quote. By the early 1970s, the situation grew worse after a series of studies revealed that radiation was even more dangerous than previously believed. In 1974, Baruch Modan showed that a woman's chances of breast cancer were increased by X-ray doses as low as 1.6 rem. 1977, Thomas Mancuso and others reported that workers at the Hanford Plutonium Facility were dying of cancer from radiation doses as low as 3 rem, accumulated over many years. The worker safety standard at the time, by the way, was 5 per year. Carl Morgan says these studies threw the nuclear industry into a panic. Quote, concerned that its very existence was threatened if the public believed that there was an increased risk of cancer at these low levels of exposure, the nuclear industrial complex determined that it would respond vigorously to all challengers. Morgan states in his biography, and as a result, health physics in recent decades has sacrificed its integrity. Certainly there remain some true professionals who will not shade the truth to appease their employers, but they are in the minority. Those words spoken by Morgan in 1999. The ICRP turned a blind eye to other problems affecting public health, excessive exposures from medical and dental X-rays. Early in the 1950s, a series of studies had shown that X-rays were more dangerous than previously known. In 1950, H.C. March showed that radiologists were 9 times as likely as other physicians to die of leukemia. 1956, Alice Stewart showed that a single X-ray of a fetus in the womb would double the likelihood of childhood leukemia. In his 1999 autobiography, Morgan refers to his 1994 description of the ICRP's failure to concern itself with excessive and unnecessary X-ray exposures from diagnostic procedures. Morgan states thusly, "It was like running into a brick wall every time I raised the question of excessive and unnecessary X-ray diagnostic exposures. I soon became convinced that the subject of excessive medical exposure was a no-no with ICRP because ICRP was founded under the auspices of the International Congress of Radiology. And radiologists did not want any restraints or interference in their use of diagnostic X-rays. I had the uncomfortable feeling," Morgan states, "that there was a serious conflict of interest with the ICR sponsorship of the ICRP. Conflict of interest seems to be a contagious and virulent disease. By the mid-1960s, Morgan's division of the Oak Ridge Lab studied the X-ray doses being received by U.S. children as a result of a mass chest X-ray program. Starting in the 1950s, portable X-ray machines in special trucks were brought to schools, and hundreds of thousands of U.S. children were given chest X-rays. The Oak Ridge study found that each of these children was receiving an X-ray dose of 2 to 3 REM. These are children! Morgan knew this was excessive because workers at the Oak Ridge Labs were getting a dose of only 0.015 REM from a chest X-ray. In other words, children were getting a dose of X-rays 130 to 200 times as high as the dose needed to produce an adequate X-ray film. Not to mention that most of the children did not need a chest X-ray at all. The mass X-raying of U.S. children was stopped by a campaign led by Morgan, Rosalie Bertel, Irwin Bros, and others. In the 1940s and 50s, many shoe stores installed fluoroscopic X-ray shoe-fitting machines. You remember those? I do. By 49, a study had shown that shoe-fitting machines were giving children high doses of radiation. Again, the ICRP showed no interest in the subject. Morgan and his colleagues calculated that medical X-rays accounted for 90% of all radiation from human-created sources. Morgan showed in 1963 that the average U.S. citizen was receiving each year about as much radiation from medical X-rays as from natural background sources. In other words, my friends, the use of medical X-rays was doubling the average person's exposure to radiation in the U.S. Morgan's point was that the same benefits could be achieved at much lower doses by using up-to-date equipment and techniques. The medical community, for the most part, turned a deaf ear. For many years, Morgan and others wrote about the hazards of excessive and unnecessary radiation exposures from medicine and dentistry, an effort he describes as, quote, 20 years of frustrating failures, end of quote. In his autobiography, Morgan says it was a highlight of my life's work when Lyndon Johnson signed Public Law 90-602, the Radiation Control for Health and Safety Act of 1968. That set minimum federal standards for X-ray equipment. However, the law can do nothing to curb unnecessary and excessive X-ray exposures, which still occur routinely. Ignorant on different subjects. We all remain ignorant until we can accept the facts. Most of us choose to remain ignorant, for it is stylish. There is not one doctor in the world today who treats cancer. First of all, my friends, it takes common sense. Secondly, it's against the law, against the establishment's wishes. And third, most doctors do not know what cancer is and deliberately, with malice aforethought, choose to remain ignorant on the subject. And fourth, it is impossible for a doctor to treat, i.e. to cure your cancer. Only you can treat your cancer. William D. Kelly, DDS, MS. Another important scientist concerned about excessive exposure to X-rays has been Dr. John Goffman. In his autobiography, Morgan describes Goffman this way. Now, when I speak about Morgan, we're talking about, I'm trying to see if I can recall the gentleman's first name, Carl Morgan, who had been head of an organization called the ICRP, International Commission on Radiological Protection. And he'd been head of that organization for 35-odd years. Morgan talks about Goffman in his autobiography when Morgan states, John Geffman, a scientist who holds degrees in both chemistry and medicine, along with Glenn Seaborg, Goffman co-discovered uranium-233, and he also was the first one to isolate plutonium. In spite of these achievements, Goffman has yet to receive the recognition due him. In my opinion, Morgan states, he is one of the leading scientists of the 20th century. Well, for 20 years or more, Goffman had been publishing studies of the hazards of low-level radiation. His latest book fills 700 pages addressing this hypothesis. He states, and this is Goffman now, medical radiation is a highly important cause, probably the principal cause of cancer mortality in the United States during the 20th century. Medical radiation is a highly important cause, probably the principal cause of cancer mortality in the United States during the 20th century. In other words, Goffman believes that medical X-rays are the major cause of cancer, including breast cancer and heart disease in the United States. Goffman's work is careful, thorough, clearly written, so most of the health physicists of this world probably cannot be expected to take it lying down. Goffman is a medical doctor, an MD with a PhD in nuclear and physical chemistry. He is professor emeritus of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Berkeley, no less, and a member of the faculty at the University of California Medical School at San Francisco. During his long career, he has pursued two separate fields of research, heart disease and the health effects of low-level radiation. Goffman, in fact, has won several awards for original research into the causes of atherosclerosis, which is the growth of fatty plaque inside the blood vessels, often causing fatal heart attacks. In 1974, the American College of Cardiology selected him as one of the 25 leading researchers in cardiology of the past quarter century. Now, in the early 1960s, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, asked Goffman to develop a biomedical research division at the AEC's Livermore National Laboratory. And the purpose was to evaluate the health effects of all types of nuclear activities. Well, in 1970, he became convinced that radiation was more dangerous than previously believed, and he spoke out against Project Plowshare. That was the Atomic Energy Commission's plan to explode hundreds of nuclear weapons to release gas trapped in rock beneath the Rocky Mountains and to excavate new harbors and canals by exploding nuclear bombs above ground. He also called for a 5-year moratorium on the Atomic Energy Commission's plan to develop 1,000 commercial nuclear power plants. By 1974, Goffman's government funding was cut. He then began a series of books on the dangers of radiation. Radiation and Human Health, 1981. X-rays, Health Effects of Common Exams, 1985. Radiation-Induced Cancer from Low-Dose Exposure, an Independent Analysis, 1990. Preventing Breast Cancer, the Story of a Major Proven Preventable Cause of This Disease, 1995, second edition, 1996. And finally, Radiation for Medical Procedures in the Pathogenesis of Cancer and Ischemic Heart Disease, 1999. Goffman, it would appear, is quite a superb teacher. In his books, he explains the raw data, where it came from, its shortcomings, and how it might be improved or why we're stuck with what we've got. Now, then he moves the reader step by step toward his conclusions, explaining each step for the novice as well as the expert. When he is forced to make assumptions, he explains why he thinks he's making the right ones. He often describes alternative assumptions and the effect they would have on his conclusions. Nothing, absolutely nothing of importance is omitted in his reports and his writings. But as a result, Goffman's books are lengthy, typically between 500 and 900 pages filled with tables of data accompanied by detailed explanations. The reader, however, does get a thorough education in the topic, satisfactory for both the novice and professional. I consider Goffman one of the greatest teachers of the 20th century. His work has already changed the way the world views the dangers of radiation, and his latest book will eventually, after a long fight, revolutionize the way the world looks at medical radiation. His work will save, cumulatively, tens of millions of lives. Reports have come out, the New England Journal of Medicine, amongst other locations. The devastation that many youths, many children are facing being put through CT scans, CAT scans as they're more commonly known. It's a tremendous concern. In Goffman's latest book, he presents strong evidence that medical radiation is a major cause of cancer and of coronary heart disease. By now, by medical radiation, Goffman is referring mainly to X-rays, including fluoroscopy and CAT scans. The mechanism is simple to state, he claims. Radiation causes genetic mutations which eventually give rise to disease, or dis-ease, as we like to call it here. What is Goffman really saying? I mean, my friends, you're out there. There's a good number of you that I talk with fairly often, or I correspond with.
All of us have been raised to believe in the system, in our doctors, our trained medical specialists. And x-rays happen each and every single day. When you go to your dentist, you need an x-ray. We're going to talk about that a little bit more a little later in this hour, because we're going to give you some things to think about. We're going to give you some questions to ask your doctors and your dentists next time that they prescribe a CAT scan or an x-ray for whatever reason, whether it's a chest x-ray or one on your arm or even the inside of your mouth. What, in fact, is Goffman saying when he talks about radiation causing genetic mutations which give rise to disease? Does he mean that medical radiation is necessarily the only cause of cancer and coronary heart disease? Of course not. Does he mean that cancer is not caused by smoking or poor diet or genetic inheritance, pesticides, diesel exhaust, dioxin, and toxic chemicals encountered on the job? Of course he's not saying that. Cancer and heart disease both have multiple causes. For a cancer to develop, a cell must undergo several, probably 5 to 10, separate gene mutations. Some of these mutations might be inherited, but most occur from exposure to gene-damaging substances in the environment. Now, here might be a way to understand multiple causation. Goffman gives the following hypothetical example of 100 cases of cancer. 40 cancers were caused by the coaction of x-rays, smoking, and poor diet. 25 cancers were caused by a coaction of x-rays, poor diet, and inherited genetic mutations. 25 cancers were caused by coaction of x-rays, smoking, and inherited genetic mutations. 10 cancers were caused by the coaction of smoking, poor diet, and inherited genetic mutations. What is interesting is diet fills all but one of those. Smoking fills all but one. X-rays is in all but one. Now, in the first case, the 40 cancers are caused by genetic mutations that are in turn caused by x-rays, smoking, and poor diet. Each of these three factors is necessary for the cancer to occur. If any one of the three factors is missing, the cancer will not occur. That is according to Goffman. Now, we can see in this example that x-rays contribute to 40 plus 25 plus 25. 90 cases out of 100 x-rays contribute to. If x-rays were not present, 90% of the cancers could not occur, according to Goffman. Now, in the same example, look at poor diet. Poor diet contributes, according to Goffman, to 75 out of the 100 cases. We can see in this example that we have x-rays causing 90% of the cancers, causing in the sense that the cancers wouldn't occur in the absence of x-rays, but we also have poor diet causing 75% of the same cancers, meaning that 75% of the cancers would not occur in the absence of poor diet. I think I agree with Goffman in theory, but I honestly, sincerely believe, yes, there are multiple causes. Does smoking unto itself cause cancer? Absolutely not.
We have reached the end of our first hour, my friends. I hope you'll stay with us for hour two of x-rays, a major cause of heart disease and cancer, as we not only bring this portion of the program to a conclusion, but also update it with brand new timely information. Beware. And as always, to health with you.
Tom Bolton for EaseOff. I know so many of you are finding our EZ4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419. Do you truly want to stay out of the system? Are you prepared to buy into the biggest scam since the Iraqi dinar? If not, then put your money where it belongs, in your possession, not in the hands of an international MLM cartel. At Kettle Moraine Limited, we will provide you with the finest Swiss-minted detachable gram sheets of pure 24-karat gold for hundreds of dollars less than the so-called privately issued credit cards with elusive gold backing. Gold backing? The only gold that I want is in my back pocket, not backed by promises of an operation even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suspect of, giving a rating of C-. To get the full story, visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com and go to the Valcombe Bullion Vault. Once you have read the whole story about the scam being perpetrated on an unsuspecting public and how you can avoid being a victim by purchasing these beautiful, barterable, tradable sheets of gold at tremendous savings and in the strictest of privacy, be prepared to take the steps to protect your wealth with the purchase of the real deal. Detachable 50-gram gold bars from Kettle Moraine Limited by calling 602-799-8214. Ask about our 1-ounce Valcombe detachable bars, which break into 1/10-ounce bars. And don't forget, for all of your precious metal needs, whether buying or having the need to sell, call Kettle Moraine Limited. Remember, no dinar, no celery, and no carrots. If you buy from someone else, tell them you want AU, not BS. Call Kettle Moraine LTD today at 602-799-8214. Kettle Moraine LTD, 602-799-8214.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.